As soon as I heard the first synthesized noises coming out of Barbara O'Reilly, I thought, whoa, this is something new.
30 years ago this month, The Who released one of the most important albums in the history of rock and roll. From the opening sound of Baba O'Reilly to Roger Daltrey's closing scream on Won't Get Fooled Again, this invigorating collection of nine songs still resonates across the airwaves, impacting generations of music fans around the world, both old and new. This record had it all. Anger and sorrow, humor and regret, passion and tumult, all wrapped up in a blistering package where the rage was as affecting as the heartbreak. And for all that anguish that runs beneath the surface, Pete Townshend bared his soul in ways that are funny, painful, and utterly life-affirming. This was also the album that introduced a new sound for The Who, the synthesizer, which added texture where needed while amplifying the band's instrumental power, which was already at a fever pitch. And in the words of John Entwistle, these were the songs that transformed The Who from an arena band to a stadium band. How you doing, everybody? I'm Jim Ladd, and coming up next, the MJI Radio Network presents the 30th anniversary of Who's Next. I'm Jim Ladd, and the story of how Who's Next came to be is a rather interesting and twisted tale. After the success of Tommy in 1969 and the incredible raw power of Live at Leeds in early 1970, the rock community was anxious to hear what The Who would come out with next. The project that Pete Townshend was working on not only was musical, but it also involved making a film.
So I was working on a very, very ambitious piece at the time, for the time, called Lifehouse, which was going to be a movie based on a live performance of The Who that was projected to last 5 to 6 days in a theatre called The Young Vic in London. And through that live performance were going to be spun a series of fictional stories, you know, that wove their way in and out of the concert. And the concert itself was also a part of the story.
Interestingly enough, the Lifehouse story bore some similarities to the album Tommy.
How could I make the subject of this new piece, this Lifehouse piece, I want the story to be about music, I want it to be about the future, I want it to be about hope and vision, but it's got to be rooted in reality, got to look at the possible problems. How could I make my character effectively deaf, dumb and blind without doing it again, you know? And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll make him live in the future and I'll put him in a suit. And he'll be in the suit, and he won't live real life. He'll live pretend life. He'll live spoon-fed life. He'll live couch potato life. He'll live the life that filmmakers, storytellers, advertisers, you know, political manipulators and brainwashers want him to live. And thus, he'll be effectively deaf, dumb and blind to his spiritual potential, which is his freedom to congregate with other human beings, interact with other human beings, and live what we now call life.
There once was a knot, pure and easy, playing so free like a breath rippling by.
Roger Daltrey.
His idea of the piece initially came from one sentence that he came out with, that if we ever found the root of all life, or the basis of all life, it would probably be a musical note. Now that in itself is a wonderful, just a great baseline for a story.
After a press conference where Pete Townshend announced that Lifehouse was the band's next project, The Who moved into the Young Vic in London for a series of experimental performances.
Well, the band would set up, we'd have our equipment set up there for a week, and we would turn up every day and we'd play. And people would just walk off the street and watch, and they'd shout out requests and we'd jam, and, you know, we'd all break and chat with people. And it would be kind of organic thing where we just experimented. And it went on, I can't remember how long it went on, but I know it was definitely more than a week. It was a good period. It really was a good period. It was all very organised in a kind of chaotic fashion, if that makes sense.
Indian Lake is burning. New York skyline is hazy. The River Thames is turning dry. The whole world is ablazing. We need water.
That was a song called Water, recorded live at the Young Vic in London. Well, following these shows and some problems that Townsend was having with the band's manager at the time, Kit Lambert, it became evident that The Who were going to have to abort the idea of making a film out of Lifehouse. Instead, it was suggested that the band go to the record plant in New York and record the Lifehouse songs for a new double album. These sessions also became another experiment for The Who, as Kit Lambert also invited guitarist Leslie West and bassist Felix Pappalardi to sit in on the recordings.
I got it all here in my head. There's nothing more needs to be said. I'm just banging on my old piano. I'm getting in tune to the straight and narrow.
Roger Daltrey.
Again, that was another experiment with Kit Lambert producing. And we invited other people playing, you know, like Leslie West played and Felix Pappalardi. And we had a lot of black girlfriends singing on backing vocals and all kinds of things. And it was kind of a very different approach to the stuff. But it was, again, a great experiment. And it only pushed it on to become the final thing it did.
John Entwistle.
I remember turning up for the first session in New York. And our manager, Kit Lambert, had called in Felix Pappalardi, and he was setting up his bass equipment when I walked in. And I went, what the f*** is this? Yeah. I've got another bass player. And what had actually happened was Kit tried to get hold of Felix Cavalieri to play keyboards, and he got through to Felix Pappalardi instead. So Felix went home.
Pete Townsend.
We had then come to New York, and with Felix Pappalardi and Leslie West, we'd done a couple of recordings at the new record plant of some of the songs from Lifehouse, including a wonderful version of Behind Blue Eyes, a great version of Won't Get Forward Again with Leslie West jamming away in the background.
It's about chemistry. The Who has a very unique chemistry that kind of takes this music that's of a very acquired taste. It's not everybody's taste. You either love it or you hate it, but it gives it an energy that is, I think, unsurpassed in most bands. And by bringing these other people in, it was, again, another really interesting time to experiment. It was just different. It wasn't necessarily better, it wasn't necessarily worse, it was just different, and it was interesting to see how it was. And if you compare the two records now, they aren't as good. For some reason or the other, musically, in musical proficiency, they might be better, but there's something lacking in the energy. Even with people like, you know, Leslie West playing lead guitar, it doesn't necessarily put more in. It's really weird, and it's to do with the chemistry.
Well, as you can hear, the New York recording sessions provided some interesting musical journeys for The Who, and some unique versions of Who's Next songs. But Townsend put a stop to these sessions after only a week, and he and the band returned to London.
We'd realized that Kit Lambert, who was our producer at the time, was just seriously strung out on heroin. And we abandoned the session and came back to London and went into the studio, really with me emotionally, mentally, physically and spiritually collapsing. and we made the album that you hear as Who's Next.
The great thing about doing those sessions was that we learnt the songs, which is very rare for the Who. Usually go in the studio, learn the songs in the studio and record them straight away, which is kind of a dangerous way of doing it. I guess we figured it'd be nice and fresh, but all the live versions of those songs are always much better because we have time to think about the parts. So good thing about Who's Next is we'd actually played it, we recorded it before, and so we knew the songs and it was well rehearsed and we'd thought of better parts to put on.
I'm Jim Ladd, and we're celebrating the 30th anniversary of Who's Next, and we'll be back on the MJI Radio Network right after this. Welcome back to the 30th anniversary of Who's Next. I'm Jim Ladd. Following the brief New York recording sessions that took place in March of 1971, The Who returned to England and, for a third time, attempted to record this vast collection of songs that Pete Townshend had written for the Lifehouse Project. And to help keep things focused, they hired producer Glenn Johns to oversee things.
Producing The Who is not like, or being, I mean, I didn't really ever produce the Rolling Stones, I was really more their engineer, but working with bands on that level is totally different from working with anybody else. I can't really remember what was my idea and what wasn't, but invariably with a band like The Who, it's fairly clear cut what's going to happen with any tune. It's developed fairly quickly in the studio. Townshend does an extremely explicit demo of anything before, which one very often ended up nicking half of to use on the record. And then you just would go for a performance from the band and whatever would happen, notes that, I don't know. It was very exciting making that record. It's certainly a highlight in my memories of the past as far as recording rock and roll is concerned. And the band, as a band, did a brilliant job on it. It was actually very simple.
Once again, producer Glenn Johns.
One of the interesting things about Who's Next that people don't ever really seem to realise is it was one of the first records where a synthesizer was used to any effect or degree, and was used quite brilliantly by Townshend. Completely different than the synthesizers that they use today, because you had to program every sound yourself. I mean, nowadays you turn it on and push a number and then you've got a sound. But the synthesizer that Pete used on that was enormous. I mean, I don't know how many feet it covered, but it was huge, banks and banks and banks of knobs. And I mean, I didn't understand the bloody thing, but that just shows you, again, he's maybe he's not underrated at all, but I mean, his knowledge, his technical knowledge is quite incredible. I mean, he actually knew how to work the bloody thing. I wouldn't have figured it out if I was still sitting there now.
Well, it was a mixture of devices. It was using organs, which were getting pretty fancy then, and synthesizers together, and trying to find ways to synchronize the clocks together, recording random sections of stuff onto tape, cutting tape up, re-recording bits of tape, cutting the tape up again and getting rhythms from it. That was really what it was all about. You know, I had a studio in my house and, you know, I had an 8-track tape machine and a dozen quarter-inch machines and a basement full of weird speakers and echo units and chains and synthesizers and oscillators and all that kind of electronic music stuff. But what I was very good at was cutting tape. I mean, in those days, electronic music was about cutting tape, and I could do that, and I could do it fast. And Barbara O'Reilly has something like 2,000 or 3,000 edits in it. The master tape goes by and it's all white, you know, it's just sticky plaster from start to finish. But what I then did is I put a piano over the top, a guitar and a vocal, and made it sound a bit more like rock and roll.
Keith Moon said, let's put a gypsy violin on this. Get Dave Arbus from, was it Fairport Convention? He'd come and do it. And there it is. And it's absolutely outstanding still today. Thank you, Keith. For me personally, as the singer, I at last had a chance to really work the dramatics of the song and feel comfortable with it before I actually had to put anything down on record. It was, that luxury was amazing to me. Because when the Who stopped being a blues band, and you have to remember that I used to kind of sing like this Chicago blues person. I mean, it was complete pastiche of it. But I mean, I was very young and naive. That was my version of being a black Chicago blues player. So that when Pete came along in the early days with all these original songs, I found it very difficult to find a voice for those. And I was kind of feeling all over. You know, I was almost like a fish out of water. But the great thing about Who's Next was it gave me the opportunity to kind of put all that blues experience and gave me the freedom to experiment without it actually knowing that it's going to be released the next week or the next day, how it used to be sometimes in those days. And I actually did find my own voice for the first time. It was great.
The one song on Who's Next that Daltrey didn't find his voice on was Going Mobile.
Well, I think that song was just, Glenn just suggested that I sit and sing it live, and I did it, and it worked. And I certainly never anticipated ever singing with The Who. I sang with The Who when I had to. I'd deliver a song, and Roger would say, not going to sing it, you sing it. And his choices would often surprise me. You know, I would think he's not going to sing this because this is too personal, or he's not going to sing this because this is about men wearing dresses, or, you know. And it would always surprise me. It would often just be because of something about the song where that he couldn't maybe capture the ebullience that was in it or something. I don't know, anyway. That I really don't know.
Roger Daltrey.
It really just suits his voice more. I mean, my voice is a heavy voice. It's much rawer. Going Mobile is a much more... I just can't imagine me ever singing Going Mobile. And it was very personal. The song was a kind of song at the time that was very personal to Pete, because he just bought this great big Winnebago and he was living in it and travelling around England. You know, so, it would have been ridiculous for me to sing it, because it was really... All the others obviously were personal to Pete, but you can make them personal to you. That's the secret of doing the job I do. But that one is just, it was completely, it could have only been Pete.
Going Mobile, a song The Who surprisingly never performed live on stage. Our 30th anniversary special on Who's Next will continue right after this on the MJI Radio Network. I'm Jim Ladd. Welcome back to our 30th anniversary special for Who's Next. We're now going to hear from someone whose unexpected gift of a red guitar played an important part in the making of Who's Next. Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Walsh.
For some reason, decided to lay a really special guitar that I found in Nashville, a Gretsch 6120, on Pete. And sometimes I really hit myself in the head, because it was a really special guitar. I used it on the first Barnstorm album, and it was a good one. And I laid it on Pete. And it was more of a melodic guitar, and it had a a vibrato tailpiece, at what we call a Bigsby, and Pete used that guitar in as like his main thing in the writing of Who's Next, and that's a really special album. And I'm not superstitious or anything, but I think that guitar had an awful lot to do with it.
I gotta lose me to find you. I gotta give up all I have. To find you, I'd suffer anything and be glad. I'll pay any price just to get you. I work all my life and I will. To win you, I stand naked, stone and stabbed.
A lot of people really have never understood how important Keith's drumming style was to the Who. And I kind of pictorially describe it as if you imagine Pete and John as two knitting needles, and Keith was the ball of wool. He would kind of keep it all together, and with the vocals on top, it would produce a product. You took Keith out of it, and it was just like...
Producer, Glenn Johns.
His sense of time was almost zero. His sense of dynamic wasn't too brilliant either. His technical ability to play the drums, in my opinion, was awful. Absolutely awful. But his energy and his approach to the Who's music, with the way that Townsend plays and the way that Entwistle played, made an extraordinary combination, and it worked brilliantly. And there's no one else can do that. He was a showman, is what Keith Moon was, and he had more energy than everyone else in the band put together, and it worked.
Who's Next included a beautiful piano contribution by the late Nicky Hopkins, and he's featured prominently on The Song Is Over, as well as this next one, Getting in Tune.
All these things were done live, so it was great, you know, and Keith and I just had such a great rapport going on that song. And after we did it, I think it was after that song anyway, Pete said to me, he said, well, how's it feel to be a fifth member of The Who? And I said, oh, I'm sorry, Pete, I've got my own album to do. I mean, it's one of those classic bungles that one regrets afterwards, but...
I'm singing this note cause it fits in well with the chords I'm playing. I can't pretend there's any meaning hidden in the things I'm saying, but I'm in tune. Right in tune, I'm in tune, and I'm gonna tune right in on you.
I mean, there's so many things you can do with Who's. Yeah, Who's Next was perfect. I mean, especially when it just worked so well with the album cover. We were on touring up in the north of England, and we drove past an old coal mine, and on the slag heap, holding the slag heap together were these huge concrete pillars. So we just got out of the car, skipped up this slag heap, you know, black, shaley crap, with this big white concrete phallus coming out of it. And the sky on the original day was completely grey. So it was very eerie. That's not the original sky in the photo. On the photo of, on the cover of Who's Next, that sky is stripped in. The original sky was as grey as the slag heap, which was so spooky. We thought, that's a bit doomy. So we went out and we photographed a sunset and stripped that in behind. And it just kind of gave it from out of this darkness and this strange phallus and us pissing on it. The whole thing just seemed to have some kind of madcap sense to it. I don't know. You know, in those kind of days of drinking and drugging that we were doing there, it seemed to make sense to us anyway. We all actually did piss on it, but then it dried out after a while, so then we had to go and find some water. you know, photographers can never do it in one photograph, can they? They have to take two bloody rolls or four rolls, you know. And of course, Moon had to have the biggest piss out of everybody else.
The 30th anniversary of Who's Next will continue on the MJI Radio Network right after this.
The fact was, it didn't really need the story to carry the songs as individual songs, which obviously Pete couldn't quite see initially because he'd written them as part of a story. They illustrated part of the script.
I'm Jim Ladd, and welcome back to the 30th anniversary of Who's Next. During the London recording sessions for this record, Pete Townshend was still hoping that the end result was going to be a double album of material based on his Lifehouse concept. But when producer Glenn John suggested that the band should only do a single album and forget about Lifehouse, Townshend was just too exhausted emotionally, mentally, and physically to put up much of a protest.
When Glenn John said, listen, I don't think it should be a double album, I think it should be a single, you know, I didn't have it in me to protest. When when Ethan Russell, Glenn's friend, the godfather of his son, was suggested as the person to take the album cover, I didn't have it in me to protest. And when he suggested that we piss up against an edifice that he found in the middle of a slag heap, I didn't have it in me to protest. So I was kind of led by my nose into what has actually become probably the most important album of The Who's career outside of Tommy. So sometimes God has his ways of making you behave.
The song is over. It's all behind me. I should have known it. She tried to find me.
There's something about these songs, the way they all knit together, that they seem to make, for me, they leave you with a great feeling. And it can be a statement, whatever you want it to be. That album makes a statement for you personally. And I think that's the secret of a great album, that any listener can get what they want out of it and make them feel great and send them going, yeah, I can get on with the day. If we'd have made it a double album, we would have had to start putting padding in. I mean, when you listen, Pure and Easy is a good song. There's no doubt. It doesn't quite cut with the rest of them. I think that's why it's not on there. I mean, Water and those songs, they're great songs, but they're not up to the standard of the songs that are on Who's Next. And I think it's as simple as that.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man. To be the sad man behind blue eyes. No one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, to telling only lies.
Behind Blue Eyes is a perfect example of the fact that The Who were a very, very dynamic group. You know, we had very, very high highs and low lows. Very much something that I think Led Zeppelin developed into their own, obviously, very private tradition, but, you know, that something that I think that people have always enjoyed in their work, that, you know, that they could go from being very, very, very heavy to very, very delicate and acoustic on the same song, on the same album.
This is Roger Daltrey, and I'd like to introduce you to a good old mate of mine. He's called The Ox, or Johnny Thunderfingers, or Big Black Johnny Twinkle, John Entwistle.
My wife has written for a solo album. They asked me whether I had any songs. I said, yeah, it's a song called My Wife. You know, which didn't fit Lifehouse's idea at all. I mean, Roger always says it didn't fit Lifehouse. It wasn't meant to. It was meant to be on a solo album. They asked me if I had any songs because it was going to become a single, non-concept album. I just had an argument with my wife, and I put the leads on my two Scottish deerhounds, and we backed onto a huge 3,000-acre park, right? And I stormed out of the house, and I was walking, and I made up this imaginary wife that was following me that was a lot more violent than my wife, obviously. My wife was 5'2½. I mean, by the time I got back, I sort of let the dogs go and rushed upstairs and demoed it, because it was one of those instant songs that you get when you get the words and the music at the same time. You know, and I was singing it to myself all the way around the park. The dogs thought it was very peculiar. You know, it kept coming back to me and thought I was calling them. But it was one of those instant songs, you know.
Stay tuned for more of the 30th anniversary of Who's Next right after this.
I'm Jim Ladd. Welcome back to the 30th anniversary of Who's Next. The final song on Who's Next stands to this day as one of the greatest rock anthems ever penned. From the opening synthesizer riff to Roger Daltrey's primal scream, Won't Get Fooled Again gives testimony to a generation's rage. Here's Pete Townsend.
Well, it started as a lyric, not as a track or a song. And it was a lyric written much in the kind of tone of We're Not Going to Take It from Tommy, this feeling of not so much a reaction against, you know, political events at the time, because there was, in Britain in particular, there was a kind of a mini Chicago 8 thing going down. A bunch of journalists had been ostracised by the establishment. Martin Sharp and Richard Neville from Oz magazine. John Hopkinson, who was one of the proprietors of the Indica Bookshop, which was a place where International Times grew, was slapped in jail for drugs charges, which were not trumped up exactly, but, you know, he was slapped in jail not because of the drugs, but because of his newspaper. And at that time, there was a kind of a vanguard of people who were looking at the big groups of the day, of which The Who were one, saying that we should do something. And I actually felt that that was almost like saying, you know, that we should be like the Abby Hoffmans or John Sinclairs or Malcolm X's or Angela Davis's of this world, and put ourselves up for some kind of election. And I actually felt I'd already been elected to do a job, and I knew what that job was. I had been elected, and it was simply to talk about, you know, the frustrations of a group of people from Shepherd's Bush. I wasn't elected to go on, you know, lead a political rally. And I actually wrote the lyric very much in that tone. And when The Who performed it, and when they recorded it, it took on a strange kind of perverse anthemic quality, the idea that, and I think that anthemic quality, that feeling of celebration that came from what was actually quite a negative comment, which is, you know, go away, leave me alone, I have a job to do and I'm not going to get involved in politics, you know, don't follow leaders, watch your parking meters, which the great man had already said, it became more an indictment of people that didn't understand what rock was already doing, you know? So when Rogers cried out, Won't Get Fooled Again, you thought, well, yeah, that's right, you know, that rock and roll's job is not to elect new leaders, it's to deal with the feelings that we actually have and to acknowledge those feelings and to give recognition and identification that we feel these things. And then as individuals, we have a job to do in society, whatever our job happens to be. We were entertainers and writers and chroniclers of feelings, and it was up to the lawyers and the politicians and the people who were interested in that kind of life to get on with the revolution, such as it was, you know. Something that I've always loved about Roger's work with me is the way that my voice in the early days, it's much better now, it's much more rounded now, but in the early days when I was writing demos, I hadn't even tried to sing properly, so my demo voice was kind of really quite thin, you know, little thin, weedy voice. And I never ever tried to sing, I just gave an indication of what it was that was required. But on some songs, you know, I actually unleashed really quite, I suppose, a frailty came out, and Roger recognized that frailty and honored it in the song, but somehow used this big macho voice to express it. And it was a kind of a game that we played. He knew that I would come up with these frailties, I knew that he would take whatever frailties I produced and yell them like a, you know, a banshee. But it worked. It always worked. I don't know why it worked, but it worked. It's one of the great kind of contracts of rock and roll, in a way, that it always worked. You know, Roger was often best when he was screaming his lungs out with the complaint of a weak man. It was almost like, do you know what I mean? His voice was a powerful voice, but he was speaking for the weak.
We recorded Won't Get Fooled Again down at Mick Jagger's house in Stargroves in Berkshire. And it was recorded on the Stones mobile unit. we just set all the equipment up in this big old house, and the guys were having dinner while I was doing the vocal, and all they could hear was this screaming, they thought so. And I just thought, well, because of the culmination of that whole synthesizer, well, it's not actually a synthesizer, it's an organ, but that whole melodic pattern, which again at that time was so different for The Who, because we're usually a full-on four-to-the-floor rock and roll band. I thought, to break it out of this, it needs something bigger than just a yeah. So I thought, well, let's make a really big yeah. And that's what it was, really. Just, you know, let's make it really big.
We'll be back on the MJI Radio Network right after this. As we wrap up our special on the 30th anniversary of Who's Next, a final word about the album from Roger Daltrey, John Entwistle, and Pete Townsend.
Well, I think it's like in anything. I think there's always groundbreaking, like Sgt. Pepper was a groundbreaking album, I think, to a certain extent. Tommy was. And I think Who's Next is one of those albums. It was a groundbreaking album. And those ones will always stand the test of time.
I think Who's Next really turned us into a stadium band rather than an arena band.
I love the album. I still love it. I think it's a classic record. It's a great record, and I think it was brilliantly produced.
And as far as the future of The Who goes...
And The Who are just about, hopefully, to go into another experimental period in September. Very similar to the Who's Next experiment. Whether it'll work this time, we don't know. But we're going to give it a try. If we come up with anything that's worth releasing, we will release a new album. If we don't, it'll be great to be with the boys anyway. We'll be playing live shows and some benefit shows and things like that. So I'm happy with that. As long as the band's there playing music of some sort, I'm really happy. Because I don't think The Who have lost anything over the years. I mean, last year proved that to me. I think we were as good last year as we were in the 70s. Not the same, but as good. It can never be the same. We're older and we haven't got Keith Moon, but who knows what we'll come up with. But if we can come up with anything that's halfway good material with the chemistry of the band. I mean, one of the biggest problems we've got to overcome is Pete's fear of not being able to write for The Who. And I don't know what he's worried about, because he's never actually written for The Who. He writes Pete Townsend songs, and then when The Who record them, they become Who songs. But, you know, if he should really look on them all as Pete Townsend songs. Maybe it's easy from my position to say that, because I'm sure I know how much pressure he feels to come up with this material. But I've been writing for the last year. I've got four or five songs. I think perhaps two of them could make a Who album. You know, the one great thing that came out of last year is that we all realise and we all own up to the fact that we miss each other. I mean, we miss the camaraderie of the band. There is a chemistry there. There is something we were gifted with within the three of us, now four of us. The three of us, then four of us. And we must treasure that, and we do. We're on a different level than we've been for years, so that's, we're feeling great about that side of it. So if it ever is going to happen, it's going to happen now.
For the MJI Radio Network, I'm Jim Land.
The 30th anniversary of Who's Next was produced by Mark Felsott and Sal Cerincione and hosted by Jim Ladd. Associate producer John Valenzuela, creative production by Stephen Carthy, and affiliate relations Maria Musative. Special thanks to Robert Rosenberg of Trinifold Management, to Dave Schultz, Ira Robbins, Carlene Donovan, Cy Langston, Kevin Berry, Lori Longo, Steve Nelson, Joe Walsh, and Steve Reynolds. The executive producer is Phil Rado, and this has been an exclusive presentation of the MJI Radio Network, a division of MJI Broadcasting.